President, have you been surprised by the intensity of the protest against your decision to send troops into Cambodia? And will these protests affect your policy in any way?
No, I have not been surprised by the intensity of the protest. I realize that those who are protesting believe that this decision will expand the war, increase American casualties, and increase American involvement. And those who protest want peace, they want to reduce American casualties, and they want our boys brought home. I made the decision, however, for the very reasons that they are protesting.
50 years have passed since President Richard Nixon dispatched U.S. troops to Cambodia, effectively escalating the Vietnam War. Massive protests swept U.S. college campuses, including Kent State University in Ohio, where four students were killed May 4th by National Guardsmen. Police bullets later claimed the lives of two students at Jackson State in Mississippi. I'm Kent Patterson. This documentary tells the story of the student protest at the University of New Mexico, where the third most violent repression of the student movement occurred that fateful spring. You'll hear voices and sounds that were originally recorded by KUNM Radio back in May 1970, along with the remembrances of movement participants half a century later. On the evening of the Kent State killings, hundreds of students jammed the Anthropology Hall at the University of New Mexico, UNM. They heard anti-war activist Jane Fonda urge total involvement for peace. The 32-year-old Hollywood actress spoke to reporters about her movement philosophy.
I don't think that violence is an alternative. I think that continual attempts at nonviolence will work. I just think that you can't try once and have it fail and then give up and try violence. You have to keep going and keep going, get more people, a large enough number that demanded what are very good demands, that things can be done.
Fonda marched with students to the home of UNM President Farrell Heady, who refused to meet with protesters. Fonda dialogued with student activist and journalist Michael Blake about the resurgent campus anti-war movement.
What are your five demands now? You're asking for to get rid of ROTC?
Strike. Right. We're asking for the top administrators of the university, that is the regents and President Heady, to wire President Nixon, condemning the action at Kent State University. And of course, we're also asking that we withdraw all of our troops immediately from Cambodia and put an end to the war in Vietnam.
The mood was split between conservatives who very much supported the war in Vietnam and those who saw this as an invasion of an independent country and they should be left to decide their own fate.
Stephen Part was a UNM graduate student and an editor of the campus newspaper, the New Mexico Lobo. Part says Nixon's war escalation thrust many into action.
It upset people, and particularly the people that were fence-sitters, because he had announced that he had a plan to end the war. And, you know, I've got these papers here in my pocket, which he never pulled out to show anybody the plan. And many, many people voted for him, believing that the war was going to end and that, you know, no Democrat could do it. Same old thing, you know, the promises you hear versus the actions you get. And all of a sudden now the war is being ramped up, not just ramped up, we're going into another country. The war is expanding. And so many people jumped off the fence and became actively engaged.
I had been against the war since 1964. It was building inside of me. Actually, a couple of years later, I would develop a pre-ulcer from watching the news, and the doctor told me, stop watching the news, because I was upset about the war. I was suspicious that we weren't being told the truth.
Originally from Chicago, Diane Layden was a 26-year-old doctoral student, an English department teaching assistant at UNM. Although Layden says she wasn't an activist prior to 1970, Kent State compelled her to take a stand.
I was shocked. I was despondent. I had a physical feeling run through my body, from my toes to the top of my head, when I saw the picture of the young girl standing over the dead man's body, that famous photo. When I realized that the troops had been called out and had shot randomly at students, that episode to me was terrifying. I was still early in my studies. It would be years later I would read about the labor movement and the use of troops to stop labor strikes, for example, and deportations of foreigners and so forth. But I hadn't come that far in my studies to put this into a context.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
Students arriving for classes on Tuesday morning stared in disbelief at the word strike scrawled on sidewalks and buildings around the campus. To many, this was the first they had heard of the rumblings of discontent at the University of New Mexico.
There was a huge opposition to the war. You know, everybody was talking about it. Obviously, people could get, most people could get deferments for being in school, but a lot of people had family and friends and neighbors that were getting drafted.
Roberto Roybal first began attending UNM in 1969. Though thousands of miles away, the war in Indochina was not an abstract conflict for young New Mexicans like Roybal.
I had two cousins that were drafted from Santa Fe, and that hit me real personally. They both came back alive, luckily, but they've been messed up ever since. One passed away about 10 years ago. The other, you know, hasn't been able to hold a job for more than 2 weeks at a time since back then in the early 70s, you know. So it was hitting a lot of people personally because, you know, I remember in high school and then, you know, with my family watching the news every night, and they had the death counts, 20 soldiers, U.S. soldiers killed here, 30 killed there. And this was on a nightly basis. It was in everybody's mind and people were absolutely concerned about it.
The day after Kent State, UNM students, supported by many faculty members, launched their strike against the National Guard killings and the war. Student-operated KUNM Radio later detailed the developments.
The strike began to gather momentum. In many classes, discussions about Cambodia, Kent State, and the strike were taking place. Throughout the morning, department meetings were being called for the purpose of drafting statements and deciding whether or not to participate directly in the strike.
Students won a partial victory when UNM President Hetty telegrammed Nixon.
I want to express a sense of deep personal concern for the acts of violence at Kent State University, and particularly for the tragic loss of life there. I must also express my very strong feeling that your decision to extend the war by sending U.S. ground troops into Cambodia was a mistake and is likely to slow down rather than step up the rate of withdrawal of our armed forces from Vietnam.
Hetty also declared a day of mourning for the Kent State students. Like her colleague Diane Layden, Albuquerque native Kathleen McNerney was a doctoral student and graduate teaching assistant in 1970. She too was against the Vietnam War.
I started opposing it pretty early, let's say 66 or 67. And then I was a VISTA volunteer in the summer of 68 and was in northern New Mexico, and that sort of radicalized me too. That's when I started working a bit for Reyes Tijerina, for example.
Besides McNerney's contact with the Tijerina-led movement that sought to reclaim lost Spanish and Mexican land grants in New Mexico, other life experiences were shaping her politics, like the police repression against anti-war demonstrators at the 1968 Democratic Party convention in Chicago, where McNerney served as an alternate delegate.
For example, at one point, the Chicago police closed off two lateral streets to the major street that was occupied by protesters, and then started coming into the crowd with their batons, just hitting heads randomly. And one person went through a plate glass window.
Well, listen. I mean, we're striking against the military. Now, why don't we march to where the military is and take the war home? Let's go!
As the UNM strike unfolded, student protesters debated tactics and strategy. They organized a student peacekeeping force and established a first aid unit known as MASH. Some briefly occupied the Reserve Officers Training Corps building on campus. Newly elected, undergraduate student body president Eric Nelson joined more than 200 student presidents across the nation in demanding President Nixon's impeachment. The call was issued more than 2 years before the Watergate burglary that led to Nixon's downfall.
My point is that at the conclusion of this demonstration, we all walk over to Rossi Chemical Engineering, and we have a...
KUNM producers later assess a strike as 70% effective.
Sleeping bags, food, and other things.
The university's flagpole became a battleground between anti-war students who supported lowering the American flag half-mast in honor of the Kent State students and counter-demonstrators who wanted the flag at full mast. For 2 days, a seesaw confrontation involved strikers, anti-strikers, student government leaders, UNM administrators, and police. It was the clash of the half-masters versus the full-masters.
One idea for what we could do tomorrow.
Kent State goes down, and we lost it on that day, man. You know, we just lost it. We didn't know what to do with ourselves. You know, we were beyond stunned and aghast at what it went down.
Then a UNM freshman from Detroit, poet Tony Seymour, became a student marshal, a member of the strikers' peacekeeping force. 5 decades later, Seymour recalls the flagpole scene.
Here I was, Mr. Hippie, you know, standing between the jocks and the protesters, you know, standing between them all, trying to keep them both cool, you know, trying to keep both sides cool, you know, just basically just telling everybody to be cool, you know, is basically what I was doing. It was gruesome, man. I mean, it was gruesome in the sense, I mean, the jocks wanted to fight. The jocks were begging for a fight. So just by staying there and keeping between the people, we were able to stop the situation from escalating.
That's as bad as anybody else. Not Bob. Don't touch.
On May 6, KUNM reported that a flag depicting a clenched fist had replaced the American flag. Anti-strikers then lowered and burned the banner of protest, hoisting the stars and stripes back up again. A scuffle broke out later that day when anti-strikers dared strikers to lower the flag. A group of African-American students took up the challenge.
Sam! Sam, come on, Sam. No, Sam, you're acting out of hand.
Authorities indicted student senator Sam Johnson and 4 other black students. Undergraduate student Senator Barbara Brown spoke out.
On May 5th, Student Senate called an emergency meeting. During this meeting, a bill was passed to lower the flag at half-mast by student senators. On May 6th, Sam Johnson, a student senator, attempted to lower the flag to half-mast. While doing so, he was attacked by a white male. During this attack, Sam Johnson had 2 front teeth knocked out and his lip was busted. At the time the white male attacked Sam Johnson, a fight broke out between black males watching the flagpole incident and white male students. 4 white students were reportedly cut or stabbed. This morning, or late last night, I was informed that 4 black students had been arrested and that 2 more had been sought. And according to the paper's statement, that's three students have been arrested and 2 are still being sought.
The indictments ignited more protests. Barbara Brown.
The black students on this campus are calling a meeting tonight at 7:00. We're also calling blacks from the community in on this meeting because we feel that this is unjust, the thing that happened at the flagpole.
Another focal point of protest during the 1970 strike was at the university's entrance facing Central Avenue, Albuquerque's main drag. garnering honks of support from passing motorists. Students erected barricades and waved placards, but protesters also became targets. KUNM reporters were on the scene.
This is Ed Scoble at the barricade on Stanford and Central. There's been an apparent hit and run here. A tan Volkswagen with one man, bearded, ran the barricade running down one unidentified victim. The victim is being attended by student medics and men from Gold Cross Ambulance Service. They're now moving the victim into the ambulance. Victim has been lying still on the ground, bleeding from the nose and the mouth. Marshals here at the barricade have the license number of the car. This unidentified student or non-student is being moved into the ambulance now. With Rob Baldwin here, who is here when the incident happened. Rob, can you tell us exactly what happened?
Well, a car came whizzing around the corner and just took three guys right out. Just hit them, didn't stop at all. Flipped them right over the car. One guy is just concussion. He's probably gone. I treated some guy for just completely ripped up back, completely scraped. The skin was scraped off his back. Another guy, apparently, his arm was wrecked.
Rob, your glasses are broken. What is that from this incident?
Early this morning, some PE major hit me in the face and knocked my glasses.
This is Marcy Cohn. I'm speaking to Robert Steinberg at the intersection of Stanford and Central. Bob, could you tell me why you're holding a rock in your hand?
I'm holding a rock in my hand because four people have been hit by hit-and-run drivers today. And I'll tell you, anyone that tries to hit me or I see anyone that hits anyone else, I'm going to put out his windshield. And that is why I'm holding a rock, and it's a rather large rock.
What do you feel about this barricade? Any feelings? Do you feel this has been successful?
I think it's a good way to bring it to the attention of the Albuquerque public. I don't feel there's too much reason to have a barricade to keep people off campus when the police will do it for us. But it's reaching the city. It's affecting people, judging by the traffic going by here.
Although UNM President Hedy attempted to close off the campus, strikers gathered by the hundreds in the New Mexico Union building. Commonly known as a student union, or simply the sub, the building stands as the nerve center of campus. Kathleen McNerney recalls the times.
I don't use the word occupied for that because the building was open and it was ours as students. And until we got a restraining order on the 8th to leave, there was nothing like occupation.
What was going on in the sub during those days that the students were there and protesting the war?
Meetings, making up lists of demands, trying to decide how to go about making those demands and where to go first, who to talk to. We talked about all of those things.
Diane Layden divided her time between the class she was teaching outside the sub and the lively scene inside.
A lot of speakers. There were strike leaders, Alan Cooper and Bill Orzin, and Eric Nelson, I believe, was president of ASUNM at that time. I was filling myself up with talk against the war. I had become mightily opposed to the war. I wish to say that when those students were killed at Kent State, that sent a feeling through me. You know, I felt that, like from my toes to the top of my head.
And I can remember huge meetings at the Student Union Building where we're trying to plan on what we should do to aid and stop the war, the U.S. war in Vietnam.
Roberto Roybal says the class visit was another favorite tactic of anti-war protesters during the May 1970 strike at UNM.
So we would go to, like, biology classes. There was one biology class, I can't remember the name of the hall, it was southwest of the Student Union Building. And I had a biology class there, but it wasn't my class, but we went to one of the huge classes. And so we wanted to talk about how biology was impacted in Vietnam. Obviously, you know, Agent Orange was being used in huge quantities in destroying forests, not to mention killing people, including U.S. soldiers. We still haven't lost since today from Vietnam vets that were poisoned by Agent Orange way back in the 60s and 70s.
I think if you have a strike tomorrow, a strike means that no one gets in the building. And it's that simple. No one goes to class.
Other issues were raised by the UNM students. These included university governance, more scholarships for Native American students, and support for predominantly Chicano maintenance workers who were trying to unionize. Race, class, and power were on the agenda. Kathleen McNerney.
Many of those issues were on our list of grievances and complaints and demands. And it was also the beginnings of many of the studies groups that continue today. Chicano studies, women's studies, Native American studies, black studies, all those things had their beginnings around that time and were talked about by the people at in the student union and organizers among the students.
Though peace and cooperation prevailed inside the student union, talk was in the air of a possible National Guard or police intervention. Student leaders drove to the state capitol in Santa Fe for a meeting with Republican Governor David Cargo, who reportedly assured them he couldn't foresee sending the National Guard to the university. Undergraduate student body president Eric Nelson shared his version of the meeting.
And we impressed upon him how he's really screwing us over with the statements he was making to the press. And if he didn't want to turn this into a war right now, he was going to have to make some sort of moderating statement to the community to keep those weirdos from stuff like out at the barricade yesterday. Okay, so he's going to do that. And as we left, it wasn't finalized, but it was a pretty strong statement. I'll have that a little later. I've got to call his office back. Okay, we talked to him about introducing a Massachusetts bill to the legislature and calling a special session. He sort of smirked and said that he was even reluctant to call a legislature into session for an ordinary session. He's as freaked out about them as I think we are.
As rumors flew, KONM News asked University President Hetty about a possible raid against the protesters camped inside the sub.
No, it's just speculation, and I think you'll understand that I'm not commenting exactly what will follow.
Meanwhile, student leader Eric Nelson addressed an off-campus press conference organized by UNM faculty members.
I came here to ask for community support for this student strike. I've been accused of trying to close the university. This is not true. I want to open the university. I want to open it to the community, students, the outside world, so long shut out. I want to open it to the issues which are now tearing our nation apart. I am proposing that this university use the next 3 weeks, the final weeks of this term, to confront at last the issues of our day, the Indochina War and the resultant conflict over this war in America. Until this conflict is settled, this university cannot make a legitimate claim to relevance in our society.
The University of New Mexico was far from alone during those days of May. Historian Kirkpatrick Sale estimates about 4 million college students were involved in anti-war protests at campuses from coast to coast. The week of Kent State culminated with an estimated 100,000 anti-war demonstrators besieging Washington, D.C. A national governor's conference scheduled for New Mexico that week was canceled because of the political crisis engulfing the United States. In sheer numbers, the massive protests of 1970 was not matched again in this country until the immigrant May Day strikes and demonstrations of 2006.
I would like to urge all of you to leave the union promptly.
The boom was about to fall on student activists. Early Friday, May 8th, UNM President Hetty arrived to Protest Central in the student union, wielding a carrot and a stick. Appealing on students to comply with the legal order to vacate the premises, Hetty offered to ask the regents to consider reopening the building if protesters first complied with the order. Students were defiant.
But I think each one who is here at this point is clearly not responding to the regent's order.
Though faced with eviction, students embarked on a peace march to downtown Albuquerque. Student strike marshal Tony Seymour was on the lookout for possible trouble.
This guy was on the fringes, right, you know, and he kept just trying to start stuff, man. He just kept trying to start stuff. You could see him. He was just trying to rile people up and all this stuff. I'm going like, dude, man. Because I remember distinctly, I remember wrapping my arm with my coat in case somebody tried to swing at me, you know, with a weapon or whatnot. I remember trying to protect myself by wrapping my arm with a coat. I remember doing that. So all I did was I just rode this cat, man. There was not a time during the march that I was not on him, you know. I was just making my presence known to him.
Seymour says he might have prevented at least one provocation, but others were lurking down Central Avenue. Approaching Old Albuquerque High School, the peaceful march was ambushed by rock-throwing high school students who were curiously out of class.
I tried to talk to a few of them in my capacity as a Lobo reporter.
Charles Andrews studied journalism at UNM. He was covering the peace march for UNM's student newspaper, the New Mexico Lobo.
And tried to determine if this was a spontaneous demonstration, if it had been egged on by some of the Albuquerque High teachers. And I personally received the response that it was all the students. I asked some of them who got them to do this, and they said the students. It was the students' idea. However, some other Lobo reporters, Michael Blake in particular, had some of the people admit to him that some teachers had been suggesting this sort of thing earlier in the day. The crowd began to move a little bit, and I came to the realization that I was being rather foolish to be standing there with long hair talking to these kids. And about 10 seconds after I split towards the marchers crowd, the Albuquerque High crowd let out a loud yell and charged towards the marchers.
KUNM reporter Andy Garmazy interviewed peace marcher Mitch Letus.
And at first, it seemed the marchers were going to join in the college group, get behind us and march on to the federal building, but this is not what had happened. It seems like a number of the teachers at the school had been distributing these red, white, and blue armbands and had persuaded the high school students that what we were doing were anti-American, obviously against the president, against the city of Albuquerque, who knows even what they fed into their heads. But the whole thing was red, white, and blue stickers on your arm, red, white, and blue banners, red, white, and blue signs. And
meanwhile, KUNM's Steve Quartermeyer had trouble trying to use one of the omnipresent payphones of the day so he could file a story.
I attempted twice earlier to phone a story in, once at the gas station, Conoco or Shamrock Station, at the southwest corner of Arnold and Central. I was informed by the manager that I was not welcome on his premises. I identified myself as a reporter. He made reference to me as a dirty long-haired hippie and threatened my life with a baseball bat. I vacated and went over to the Conoco station at the northeast corner, got permission to use the phone, but in getting prepared to report my story, I was cut off by the manager there.
Outside Albuquerque High, Charles Andrews suddenly saw a big rock hurling at him.
The rock hit me squarely in the right eye. I was wearing sunglasses at the time, which probably prevented worse injury than I received, but I just kind of saw a big flash and almost blacked out. I went down on one knee, and before I could even fall to the pavement, somebody grabbed me by the arm, and a few seconds later, someone else grabbed me. I believe it was student marshals.
Andrews was rushed to Presbyterian Hospital and treated. Half a century later, he recalls those moments.
They couldn't do anything for the damage to the eye. When you get a hard blow like that, it will usually form liquid on the retina. And the doctor told me that how quickly the liquid drains and how completely determines how much eyesight you have left. That doctor, whose name I can't recall now, but I went to him the rest of my life, he said he had just come back from service in Vietnam, and he had never seen a blow to the eye that was harder than that.
The Lobo's former arts and media editor has since lived with the loss of about 50% of the vision in his right eye.
Especially around that time, there were people coming back from Vietnam with, you know, legs gone and arms gone and actually blinded. So I've always just considered it a bit of an annoyance. It ruined my depth perception. It ruined my pool and ping pong games. Didn't stop me from playing basketball.
KUNM credited student marshals for repelling the attack and allowing the march to resume. Protesters later headed back to campus. Kathleen McNerney relates what happened next.
We were seated in the student union building and told to leave because of the restraining order. And some people did, but most people stayed there. We were seated on the floor in one of the rooms in the sub, and the police came. They were well-behaved and peaceful, too. They tapped each person on the shoulder, and the person got up and went with them to the bus to be taken to the county jail.
And you spent the night in jail, correct?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, it was crowded and uncomfortable for everybody. The women were in the drunk tank, and the men were in some other area. And we just sort of waited all night. I don't think they gave us any food. People were hungry and cranky. But we were released the following morning, thanks to James Toulouse, the lawyer working pro bono, but I believe with the ACLU.
Diane Layden was also arrested in the sub.
I was married at the time. My husband also was arrested. I knew the other teaching assistants who were arrested. We were taken down to the county courthouse and interviewed. Then it got a little scary because, okay, they asked for the name of my parents. I was 26 at the time. I was about to turn 27. I gave them the name of my parents. And they asked for my siblings, and I didn't want to. I felt my sister wasn't responsible. My parents were stuck with me, but I wouldn't give them the name of my sister because I suddenly realized they were getting information about me that might never leave the record, so to speak.
31 women and 100 men were detained for violating the university's court order to leave the sub, including Roberto Roybal.
So they took us down to the city jail. And I can remember it was really almost kind of funny because there were, I can't remember, three or four, five buses going down there. And I can remember people driving past and yelling at us and raising their fists and encouraging us on. And I remember they were passing us six packs of beer. So, you know, on the way down, you know, so.
So you guys had a good time going down to jail, right?
Well, if you can put it that way. And then, of course, when we were in jail, they really tried to put a lot of fear in the women. They were telling the women that they're going to be in jail for months now, because I had some good friends, female friends that were arrested, and they were saying that particularly the women, they were telling them all these lies just to scare the hell out of them, and it worked. A lot of people were really scared.
The protesters were released the next day, and the UNM students put on university social probation. But something else big happened that afternoon of May 8th, 1970.
You know, it was a bright, sunny day, and nobody was expecting any kind of violence. There were families pushing strollers and people walking with sodas going back and forth across. And down at the end, there's troops piling out of the backs of the great big, you know, 6x6 trucks.
As police were detaining student strikers on one side of the student union building, the New Mexico National Guard was mobilizing on the other side of the sprawling complex. Graduate student Stephen Part showed up to take photos for the Lobo newspaper. Part says he saw guardsmen wearing gas masks and carrying rifles.
They begin kind of a charge. They're not running, but they're at a fast forward, pointing their bayonets at people and jabbing at people. And I see African-American student, I find out later it's Flowers, being butt-stroked right off of his crutches. And then find out later Steve Sullivan is one of the kids that goes over to help him back up so he can walk. And as he is helping him up, at no threat to the National Guardsman bayonets him right in the crook of his arm.
Although he was wearing a helmet marked press, part was bayoneted in the back and taken to the hospital.
Emergency room nurse comes out and says, "Part." I said, "Yep." She said, "Are you the last?" I said, "I guess so." It was a long time that I was sitting there. She brings me into an examining room and said, "Where did they get you?" And I showed her, and she said, "Okay, well, sit up on that table and take your pants down and let me look at it." And as soon as I took the belt off, the pressure on the wound was gone, and it was like a gusher.
KUNM ran a UPI wire service story quoting National Guard warrant officer E.G. Gonzalez as declaring there were no bayonettings. Station reporter Ed Scoble interviewed a National Guard medic.
Sir, if you could tell me, did you treat anyone injured today, particularly from bayonets?
I personally didn't. However, some of my colleagues did. And the report I got was that it was mostly an accident, you know, the way it happened. People got in the way, or somebody was trying to help someone else and didn't get out of the way of the marching troops on time. As far as I could ascertain, it was, through no willful intent that anyone was stabbed with a bayonet.
I see. Any of these accidents were of a serious nature, or would you say mostly superficial wounds?
I would say most of them were superficial. However, one seems to have been relatively serious. One of the reporters, I believe, had his arm injured fairly severely.
KUNM's manager at the time, Stephen Van Dresser, filed a report on University President Hedy's reaction to the National Guard action.
In his news conference this evening, Dr. Hedy stated that he had no foreknowledge that National Guard troops would be called to the University of New Mexico campus, and in fact only knew of their presence after they had arrived. The timing was critical. The regents were meeting with the president at the time the police and the National Guard arrived and went as rapidly as possible to the New Mexico Union building. They had not known exactly at what time the confrontation would occur.
Following the bayonettings on the UNM Mall, guardsmen briefly occupied the Student Union. KUNM journalist Andy Garmazy caught up with National Guard Adjutant General John Pershing Jolly. 3 years earlier, Jolly had overseen the National Guard troops who were deployed against Reyes Tijerina's Alianza land-grant organization in northern New Mexico.
Well, we're under the operation of the state police, and whatever Captain Hill asks us to do, we will do.
I take it that you'll be spending the night here?
Me personally, no. I'm going back to Santa Fe.
What about the National Guard themselves? I see they're moving in their duffel bags.
I believe that's the order, that they're going to stay here all night.
Former UNM students who were arrested at the Student Union sit-in say they didn't find out about the National Guard incursion until the next day. Kathleen McNerney and Diane Layden remember.
Well, we were horrified. Quite a few people, 11, I believe, were wounded, and some very severely wounded, and including a person that was trying to leave and was on crutches, and he was wounded.
Both the governor and President Hedy didn't want bullets in the guns. There weren't bullets in the guns, but they came on campus with fixed bayonets. There is a famous photo you can find of a woman being held by her elbows by two men, and they're running from the guard. It's a frightening photo. To me, that photo, it's like the photo of the woman standing over the body of the student at Kent State. It captures what that was like.
Then there were units that were mostly from the small towns around Albuquerque, like Las Lunas, Belen, different areas, and they were mostly Chicanos, too.
Roberto Roybal.
The National Guard were being told that we were armed and violent, and they came just scared as hell, not knowing what was going on. For a lot of them, that was that first kind of confrontation they had. And they gave them bayonets. They had bayonets on their rifles. So they ended up bayoneting several people. I had a couple friends that were bayoneted. One was Steve Sullivan, who was with one of the MASH units, the Mobile Student Hostel units. He was cut in the arm. A reporter, I believe, if I remember correctly, was also cut. And later on, they tried to say that the people weren't cut by bayonets by the National Guard, that they were cut by rose bushes.
In his book about UNM, former Regent Calvin Horn likewise cites a phony state police intelligence report. In fact, Governor David Cargo had delegated command of the National Guard to State Police Chief Martin Vigil before departing on a fishing trip, which was cut short when Cargo's fishing buddy had a heart attack. Though Cargo was the commander-in-chief, Vigil assumed responsibility for calling out the guard.
Our primary interest was the protection of the students involved.
Hours after the bayonettings, Vigil held a news conference at the National Guard Armory in Albuquerque.
I think that had we not taken the necessary precautions and had the manpower that we did, we would have been negligent, really, in trying to correct this thing.
Chief Vigil differed with Farrell Heady's statement that he and the UNM Regents had no foreknowledge of the police and guard deployment to the Albuquerque campus.
Well, all I can say is that he did know.
Vigil characterized the guard action as coming off extremely well. He was joined by National Guard General Donald Doan.
There were some incidents. These are being investigated through our own channels. At the same time, through our medical section, all of the incidents of the so-called knivings and bayonettings have been checked out, some of which have been very, very highly blown up already, of people dead and dying, to where two Band-Aids got them out of the hospital.
The press conference turned contentious. Of the 11 people wounded in the guard sweep, three of them were local media workers: Bill Norlander of KOB-TV, Stephen Part of the Lobo, and Gary Klein of the UNM News Bureau.
And let's face it, gentlemen, you all look alike.
Well, I imagine.
With cameras in, without. Now,
coming at you with
there were many, many, many students out there tonight with cameras.
Just so happened that General, sir, this gentleman stood up in front of an approaching National Guardsman with this camera in his hand and said, "I'm a newsman."
Mm-hmm.
And they perfectly ignored it. It stabbed him three times. An eighth of an inch more would have killed him.
I say he had two scratches. All I know is what the medical reports say of the hospital.
Medical reports say he was in there.
Gentlemen, we're not here to argue. We're here to tell you why we did what we did, and we're not here to argue all of this stuff. So please limit your questions to the operation.
KUNM quoted Dr. Leonardo Garcia as saying bayonet victims Steve Sullivan and John Dressman most certainly would have bled to death before reaching a hospital if no volunteer strike medics had been present to render first aid. Part and five other bayonet victims sued New Mexico officials for civil rights violations, but they lost the case in federal court. Part contends an unfriendly jury ignored evidence of wrongdoing, like the bayoneting of a UNM staffer.
One was an adult in his 40s who worked for the University Information Service. He was on his coffee break, standing out front of the student union, smoking his pipe and watching what was going on. He was up on the steps by the door, and a National Guardsman had to run from the mall up those steps to get him.
For the historical record, David Cargo insisted in his autobiography that Heady and the Regents requested the guard's presence. But Cargo's book contains factual errors, and 1970 veterans interviewed for this story generally support Heady's account that he and the Regents were in the dark about the guard deployment. Stephen Part recalls later confronting Cargo at a public event in Albuquerque.
A politician walked me into a corner and started talking about the Rose Bush and how it never happened and all this. And I said, "Look, I'm number 11. I got bayoneted." And he pulled out his card and gave it to me and said, "Steve, we have to have lunch together sometime and talk about this because you're remembering things differently." And I said, "I was there. I wasn't up in Chama fishing."
But there were some who strongly applauded the guard incursion. For instance, New Mexico State Senator George the Blade Coran even suggested more funding so the guard could purchase honing stones to keep their bayonets sharp. Harvard's Joseph Rhodes Jr. came to Albuquerque in the summer of 1970 to investigate the UNM violence. Rhodes was a member of the president's commission on campus unrest.
It seems to me there was no question that the National Guard was unneeded and provided a provocative function, which really brings into question the whole judgment of the use of the National Guard on campus disturbances. And, everyone I've talked to has indicated the National Guard actions were totally uncondonable. Provoke people, threaten people's lives, threaten citizens, not just students, with actual death, with execution on the spot.
Anti-Vietnam War activism flared for a couple more years after the 1970 repression. Obtaining equal time approval by the school board, Roberto Roybal recalls speaking to high schoolers.
So I can remember very vividly going to the gym at the old Albuquerque High School, and the gym was full of students. And they had these military folks in there, from the Navy, Marines, Army. They were all there, big old tall soldiers and sailors and all this kind of stuff in their uniforms and medals. There was a couple or three of us, with our headbands, and jeans and growing my hair long and that kind of stuff, right? But they gave their spiel on why the students should enlist in the Army and the Navy and all that. And so we got our turn. We were telling students why they shouldn't go. We were telling them our version of what was going on in Vietnam. People were going there to die for oil, that they were going to be drafted, be forced to go there, that tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers had already been killed in Vietnam. And for what, That's halfway around the world. What are we doing there?
The Vietnam War finally ended on April 30th, 1975, when the People's Army of Vietnam and the National Liberation Front marched into Saigon and toppled the U.S.-backed government. That event happened 5 years to the day Richard Nixon announced the military escalation that triggered Kent State and the student revolts at UNM and across the land. Fifty long years have passed since the spring of 1970. The veterans of UNM's student strike pursued different life paths. Some stayed in Albuquerque while many others left long ago. In one way or another, memories of the days of May have stayed with them. Diane Layden.
I had a student in the cell with me. I've since contacted her. I found her in California. She was crying and crying, and I wrote about this in my article. She had the list of all the people who were arrested with their family members and their phone numbers and so forth. And it was her job to notify all the families that their daughter, sister, wife, cousin had been arrested, and let them know that this person was okay. But she got caught up in the sweep, and she was very upset. So at the time, I perceived myself as the oldest person in the cell and the only teaching assistant, I thought. I didn't know Kathleen at the time. So I asked to speak to the officers who were in charge, and there were two sheriff's captains who came to the cell, and I told them, I introduced my student, and I showed them all the lists she had and asked if she could be released so she could notify the families. And they released her. And this is one of the great moments in my life when I felt I was effective.
Former Lobo editor and KUNM DJ Charles Andrews moved to California in 1980. For a long time, Andrews has written for the Santa Monica Daily Press. Not bitter, he reflects on that old downtown high school where his life was changed so many springs ago.
Albuquerque High School at that time had the greatest number of black students and a lot of Latin students too, Latino, Chicano. And the organizers made the error of believing that those students which we all considered to be, you know, cannon fodder for the war in Vietnam. A lot of them were drafted disproportionately. So we thought that they would have sympathy and would join the march. What they didn't count on was the tradition of military service that existed among the families of the kids at Albuquerque High. You know, my dad was a Marine. My grandfather was in the Army. Two of my uncles are in the Navy. So they were not sympathetic to the cause at all. And what we heard, which was never proven, but I heard it from several sources, was that the ROTC teacher at the school had sort of whipped his troops into a frenzy, the students, and told them to go out and you know, attack those commie hippies.
Ex-student marshal and KUNM DJ Tony Seymour became a West Coast poet after leaving Albuquerque in 1973. In light of the government's spying and dirty tricks of the 1970s, Seymour suspects that instigators in the mold of the notorious undercover police agent, Tommy the Traveler, were at work in Albuquerque, too.
You see, what you got to realize is that the feds and all that were deep into Operation COINTELPRO at the time, and they had a bunch of agent provocateurs that they were bringing out on campuses. And that's my whole theory, was that a lot of that stuff, a lot of the provocational stuff, agent provocateurs, a lot of those agent provocateurs brought in.
If you go to UNM these days, you might notice a small plaque on the school's outdoor mall near the spot where 11 people were bayoneted and injured by the National Guard 50 years ago, the day that became known as Bloody Friday. The plaque honors late President Farrell Heady for steering the university through trying times. But you won't see a memorial for the student strikers or bayonet victims.
I think this needs to be remembered.
Stephen Part became a high school teacher in Albuquerque. Part says he'd get mixed reactions from his students when the subject of the UNM strike came up. And he recalls how the memory of May 1970 was gradually erased over at UNM.
Steve Sullivan's blood was out by that door, and the art students used to come out every couple of years and varnish it. So it was right by that front door. And then my daughter, who graduated from UNM a few years ago, said that when they were remodeling something out there, it was just swept away. And when she told some of her friends what was going on, not only had they never heard about the, what I call the National Guard incursion, they didn't know that students had been bayoneted, that they'd sort of heard of Kent State when they were in high school and taking U.S. history, but they had no idea anything like this had happened in the very city where they'd grown up or the college they were now attending.
So we do a lot of youth engagement. And I've gone to different kinds of conference, youth conferences that we've organized.
Roberto Roybal passes on the historical memory of May 1970 to new generations of activists. He's a longtime staff member of Albuquerque's Southwest Organizing Project, a group which formed in 1980 and achieved national and international stature as a formative organization in the environmental justice movement.
And I've talked to students about, you know, the power of organizing. And I talk about that student strike and what we did as youth, as students, and that we shut down the University of New Mexico. And, you know, people can't believe that people could have that kind of power to do something like that.
Kathleen McNerney finished her PhD at UNM. She helped start women's studies at the school, moved to West Virginia, and taught about Catalan women writers before later retiring back to her hometown of Albuquerque. McNerney reminisces about the past, but also embraces the future.
Well, I have to say this time is very, very discouraging. But the lesson learned is that you have to keep pushing and pushing. There are many setbacks along the way, and we've got a very big setback in the White House right now. But we can't give up. We've got to keep working. I'm obviously not as active as I was a couple decades ago, but I still do what I can. And I hope others will do the same.
Diane Layden also got her doctorate. She worked a spell in the personnel department of the county government and taught at Central New Mexico Community College.
My participation in the anti-war protest of May 1970 is one of the highlights of my life. I feel I made a contribution to peace, and it was for myself, as hopefully for others, that we can't accept war as a fait accompli. We need to object, and I'm glad that I did.
The Days of May, UNM 1970, was produced at KUNM Albuquerque by Kent Patterson. Technical assistants, Marty Adam Smith and Ali Liddell. Music, Neil Young, Barbara Dane, Phil Oakes, The Jefferson Airplane, Frida Payne, Melanie, and the Edwin Hawkins Singers. This program was made possible by the student journalists of KUNM and the New Mexico Lobo, who documented a crucial historical moment. Additional thanks to UNM Center for Southwest Research. Portions of this documentary were reconstructed from the 1971 KUNM special, May 1970, 6 days of protests at the University of New Mexico. For comments and questions, please email kentnews@unm.edu. That's all one word, kentnews@unm.edu. The producers of this program are solely responsible for its contents. I'm Kent Patterson.